Hi, before we start today's episode, we thought we should just say that we're going to release this ahead of our Saturday schedule. Obviously, events happening in Minneapolis are taking like the fore, so we thought we should just let you guys know that there is a protest happening this Saturday in Dublin outside the US Embassy. Those of you who want to go, it's going to be in Ball's Bridge around about 3 o'clock. obviously, we're still in the middle of the COVID lockdown. So like you'll need to make sure that you're still socially distancing and looking after yourself. You don't really want to give the police an excuse to arrest you, and they will. So yeah, look after yourselves, go along if you can, show your support. Thanks. Hi guys, it's your weekly anime podcast coming live from the shores of the Thames Estuary. This week we're looking for Jeffrey Epstein, who obviously remains alive, at 10 Downing Street, the centre of unaccountability. Today's podcast features Dan, James, Alex and me, Will, and we'll be talking about Dominic Cummings, what happened and why it matters. We'll also be talking about class relations and why these are weird. Hope you enjoy the show.
Yeah, I think Usheen's not coming because he implied to me he could have done later, but he can't do this time. He might appear at some point. So.
Oh, cool.
Like a random Usheen appears. You know, not to go back to Pokemon.
I was going
to
say, that's a goddamn Pokemon reference, isn't it?
It is. Yeah.
God damn it.
So will we just start?
Yeah,
let's do that.
How's Dad doing? How you doing?
I'm not too bad, not too bad.
Half time done.
You're done. You're well done. I think I've caught a mild sunstroke from being in the garden earlier for about 10 minutes.
You couldn't be any more English right now. You could be invading. It's true. Yeah, it's weird. Can everyone make sure that they have a name? So I'm poop on a bench. Dan, can you go into your thing?
I can.
Into your gesture. You can give yourself a name. So Will is not a cop. Will, James is Dr.
So like before you go on, I'm glad you've got that on record. thank you. You've fallen perfectly into my trap. I played that beautifully for myself.
Yeah, you won that one. Okay, I'll give you that. What's higher than a cop? You're a tout. You're worse than a cop. You're a tout.
Oh, shit.
What's bigger than a cop? A police cop.
Oh, shit.
It's the worst kind of cop.
Police cop.
A butter cop, yeah. Bum Candy is Will.
No,
not Will, sorry, Dan.
Not a cop. We've decided.
Will is NAC, whatever that means, and Dr. Bumjuice is James. I am poop on a bench. So welcome to this week's anime podcast. This week we're going to be talking about Dominic Cummings, which is presumably something he's very happy with at the moment. There's a amount of people discussing him and his strange head. His head looks a bit like that guy from the Third Rock from the Sun, John Lithgow.
John Lithgow.
There's a Dan Dare character called the Mekon, and it is the spitting image of Dominic Cummings. It's this alien with a bulbous green head.
And honestly, it is. You look at the picture.
I think he looks like a drag queen, but without the makeup on. He always looks like just the core of a drag queen.
So the middle stage, or like the early stages of a drag queen becoming a drag queen?
No, as in like before they put the makeup on.
Oh, okay. So a guy.
Yeah.
No, he looks like some guy.
They got a specific look before they put the makeup on because, like, you need to have short hair for the wigs, etc., etc.
Yeah.
So, for anyone that's listening that doesn't know the story, which seems unlikely at this point, does one of us want to give some? I mean, make it minimal because I find it very unlikely that someone hasn't heard this story. Does anyone want to just give a basic kind of what exactly happened with Cummings and his goings? Hey. Will, would you like to try?
Sure. So basically, Dominic Cummings, at the peak of lockdown, his wife contracted coronavirus, or so they think. So they thought the intelligent thing to do was, instead of asking a near neighbour for help with childcare, and on the event that Dominic Cummings himself would like succumb to coronavirus, they thought it would be a good idea to drive 260, 270-ish miles from London to Durham to self-isolate or, you know, quarantine themselves in one of the many apparently concrete blocks in his father's large estate. He says it's a concrete block. I have no, like, there's no way it's a concrete block. On his father's estate. So,
Is this the same father? Or is it his father-in-law who was a eugenicist?
That's his father. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So his dad. Like, nice. A video has just come out of his dad saying, you know, like, some people have just got great genes for like making businesses, and unless you've got a business, please don't marry my family. It's pretty disgusting. So Dominic Cummings takes himself up there against the advice of literally everyone, and. They isolate apparently for 14 days. On the 15th day, which is what, like twice as crap as God or whatever. On the 15th day, Dominic Cummings reports having weird eyesight, but is desperate to get back to work because why wouldn't you? And he thinks the best way to test his eyesight is to take his wife and his 4-year-old child on a 60-mile round drive to Durham Castle.
Can we just break in and say that even Chris Morris could not have come up with something?
No, not at all. It's ridiculous. So they go to Durham, like to what's it called, Bernard Castle or whatever, and they don't just drive there. Of course, what they do is they also stop and take a walk around the woods as well. And this is purely to test his eyesight, of course, because like you know, you could go to Specsavers, you could go to an optician, you could leave it a couple of days. But no, what to do is get in your high-powered Land Rover and drive to Bernard Castle and back, and then take a walk in the forest. It also happened to be Easter Sunday, and it also happened to be his wife's birthday. But that's obviously not the motivation. The motivation was purely to test his eyesight with his 4-year-old child in a car.
So all of that stuff we now know. So what happens next? So this was a while ago. This was, you said, it was in March or in April?
This is in April, yeah. So like,
it's a while ago. Why did it come out now, but why did it make such a big, why did the chattering classes go ape shit over this? And I'm going to leave this to you three, since you're all a big bunch of tans. James is kind of half tan now. Dan's half tan. James has been adopted by the Irish. And we'll see about that. But you're tan enough, so does anyone want to go?
You are talking to a tan.
Three tans. So, okay, tans, what do we think of this from our tannish perspective? Let me see those hands. It's Bum Candy, so that's got to be Dan.
I mean, to me, it's given the amount of planning involved in sort of retroactively changing his block, they must have known it was going to come out at some point. And it almost seems like from the Trump playbook, a way to weaponize sort of an anti-media message, because they know as soon as they start to bring Brexit into anything, suddenly it's polarized. You don't have to I think for a lot of people that are really pro-Brexit and just want it regardless of what the consequences are, it seems to me that it doesn't matter what they do as long as they do what they say they're going to do with regards to Brexit. So it's very sort of Trump playbook.
Absolutely, yeah. Dr. Bumjuice, I see you wiggling in the corner.
So I'm going to deploy my catchphrase here. But I mean, it's completely a psyop because I'm not sure how it got leaked in the first place. That I can't remember. But the point is that it's very much a dead cat scenario where the Tories are not looking good in terms of, you know, the PPE that they've supplied, the testing that they're doing, the fact that they took so long to go into lockdown. So there's a lot of, you know, bad news waiting in the wings for them. And this is just a classic case of something that, like, it's bad, but it's not that bad compared to the rest of the stuff that the Tories are doing.
Yeah.
But because it offends middle class sensibilities, purely because it's like they've had to suffer a little bit, you know, they've decided that even though the middle classes are like a lot of people like The Guardian are fucking loving the fact that they can just sit at the curtain all day and then phone the police because someone's went to the shops twice. it's like it's offended their sensibility because they've had to give up a little bit of power or a little bit of what they enjoy, and Dominic Cummings has either purposely flout, well, he did purposely flout it, and so then that they can talk about because it directly affects them, other than, you know, the fact that however many people are dying, what is it? It's like 40,000 now? Something like
47, according to
60,000 excess deaths for the two, three-month period.
Yeah.
64,000, actually.
That's the news. That's what's really happening. But it's easier for, you know, someone that they express to have an understanding of someone breaking a rule that they want to follow other than a materialist understanding of what's actually happening. And everyone's just effectively getting played because it's almost a non-news story. It's bad, and he should probably face, you know, like charges, as we well know that he's not, because, you know, the police have already investigated it and said it was a minor breach, even though it broke like almost every single rule of the lockdown. But we're talking about it now. It's taking up so much media time, and the real news is getting buried underneath it.
So I think at this point we need to hear from Not a Cop Will.
Good, good. So the news story broke because the Daily Mirror, apparently two people came forward to talk to the Daily Mirror about it. Which is how like the story was grabbed in the first place. The Daily Mirror like splashed it across their pages. I think like the day after or whatever, after they did the due diligence as journalists, because they knew Cummings would sue if it wasn't true. So they did their thing of like, you know, like checking out their sources, all that kind of jam. It was then on the Andrew Marr show, and then, you know, there was like various interviews. The police confirmed that they spoke to Dominic Cummings' father. What did I say? Dominic Cummings? Dominic Cummings' father. And Dominic Cummings obviously gave like a now infamous press statement a couple of days after that. I think like I obviously like totally agree with like James's view of it. I think the thing that offended me, I mean, I don't have kids, so I don't care. But like, I think the thing that offended me particularly wasn't that he was a hypocrite, which they're Tories, of course, they're hypocrites. The thing that really annoyed me about this was the exceptionalism most expressed in this act. So Dominic Cummings said he did what every reasonable parent would do in his circumstances. But the point is that it wasn't a reasonable circumstance. Like, he was asking literally the entire country to be unreasonably self-effacing in an unreasonable situation. But like, of course, the rules didn't really apply.
Isn't it pretty similar to what Jacob Rees-Mogg said about Grenfell, though? Because he said anyone with common sense would ignore the police and what the fire brigade was telling them and would have left. He said basically, anyone in the building was stupid because they didn't try and get out, even though the fire brigade was telling them not to.
Yeah, Jacob Rees-Mogg basically said if I had been in the fire, I simply wouldn't have burned to death.
But you can't kill.
But a bum candy needs to speak.
There's a guy called Craig Murray. He's a former diplomat. He's worked within the civil service, and he's kind of leans a bit towards conspiracy sometimes, but more so because you can't always verify the stuff that he talks about. But there's a lot of stuff that he talks about where he can be quite accurate. He made the connection between the visit to Barnard Castle, and the fact that there's a big GlaxoSmithKline production facility there. It's a big one as well. And given that Dominic Cummings is the kind of guy that doesn't like the process of tendering public services, there's some people suspecting there's possibly something to do with a vaccine going on there, some sort of deal in the background. Sorry. And it's actually the outrage about this is sort of covering the fact that he was there for this.
Can we just, because we didn't reiterate it, or not reiterate, I didn't say it at the beginning, who the fuck is Dominic Cummings? Like, what's his actual title and what does he do? Anyone else?
Yeah.
Oh,
I got my hand up, man.
Yeah.
Oh, shit. Go ahead.
So, this was going to tie into what I was going to say anyway. So, Dominic Cummings is what would be called as a brain genius. where he's effectively a special advisor to Boris Johnson now. I can't exactly remember when that happened, but he was one of the masterminds, in quotation marks, of the Brexit campaign. And this is why some parts of the press have a hard-on for him, and some of it's for hate and some of it's for love, where because of Brexit and how shoddy the Remain campaign was, Dominic Cummings didn't do an especially good campaign. But what he was able to do, along with, you know, is the rest of the people there, was stoke enough hate that had been preceded by, you know, about 30 years of EU bashing to get a populace to vote in their favour. But the liberal media have to paint him as some sort of Machiavellian genius, because otherwise they would have to admit that
dumb.
Yeah, that they're fucking shit and their campaign was crap. And so that's where he really comes from. He really made his name in the Brexit vote, and so far as that, there was a film made, I think it was a TV film, but it was a film made where Bindigabitch, whatever you call him, played him. And it obviously he only plays like mildly autistic like brain geniuses, so it's very on brand.
Well, I had no idea that was a movie. That's fucking stupid. Who played Boris Johnson?
I don't think Boris, I haven't seen it, but Boris Johnson wasn't like a main character in it for what I know. I think it might have been like a character actor of the side, like whoever played Blinky Ben in The Thick of It, you know, that would probably be the sort of role he'd pick up for.
So is Cummings, could you define him as a spin doctor, a bit like Alistair Campbell?
Very much so.
Yeah, he's kind of like the, like, dare I say, the dark Alistair Campbell.
Wasn't there a character in The Thick of It who actually was the equivalent of Malcolm Tucker in the Tory party? He looked a bit like a fat Dominic Cummings.
What's that guy's, like, the guy in real life who that's a parody of? I've forgotten his name. It's not Dominic Cummings, but yeah.
It was the Cameron's Blue Sky thinker, wasn't it? That he was taking the piss out of.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. But anyway, the thing we should probably get to about this is, what does this say about, I don't want to use the word democracy, but what does this say about the political system in Britain? And in particular, what does it say about the opinions of the elite, the opinions of, might as well fucking call them the aristocracy and their media men, of the population? Because clearly, they don't, from my perspective, they don't think much. So I already see two hands. So I'm going to go with Bum Candy. I think he was there. Not a cop will. Pardon me. Go for it. Not a cop will.
I don't mind if James wants to go first.
Dan, the half-tan man. Go ahead.
Oh, is it Dan? Sorry.
Yeah. I think basically it shows you that a lot of how British Parliament works, or Westminster at least, it's on tradition and kind of an honour system, really. There's no hard and fast rules. I mean, I read quite a good article last night, and it was about Dominic Cummings' sort of rise to power, if you will. And he was Michael Gove's special advisor at the Department of Education from 2011, I think. And this is why Michael Gove is especially hated by teachers, because he was running his whole eugenics, genetics sort of program through as part of the Department of Education. But he's got utter contempt for tradition and all that sort of stuff. I saw him, it was a Guardian article of all things, but it was quite a good one. And it was called a Robespierre by his teacher, one of his lecturers in Oxford. So basically he hates systems, but he wants to replace systems with a system, which I thought was quite a good point. But he basically doesn't care about the institution of Parliament, as long as all he cares about is getting his own way. He's got a vision of the UK as basically a huge sort of DARPA research facility, as far as I can tell, sort of like the English version of the American sort of research projects. And I think the guy's a fucking nut job, to be honest.
Yeah, not a cop will. I hear you talking. Go.
So, the thing with Dominic Cummings and what it says about British democracy is Dominic Cummings is not elected. And it was remarkable that he actually gave a press conference, because normally these people really avoid public scrutiny. Like, the line when you're a special advisor or a spin doctor, as he is, and as Alistair Campbell was, is you are not the story and you cannot become the story. And because if the public know your name, you're done. So, Dominic Cummings isn't elected. He's got this massive salary and he's got direct influence over the Prime Minister. In fact, at one point in his press conference, he said he has to decide dozens of times a day who gets to talk to the Prime Minister. Now, this is like an unelected gatekeeper, controlling the information channels to Boris Johnson and the UK Prime Minister. And I find it really concerning. It's really awful. And the thing that I suppose Dominic Cummings has really expressed during this is his utter contempt for public opinion.
Yeah.
He said the public are wrong about their interpretation of what he's done. The media is wrong about their interpretation of what he's done. The police, who have now said he's broken the rules, are now wrong about the legality of what he's done. The scientists are wrong about what he's done. Everyone is wrong except him. And because of his position of incredibly elevated power, he can totally get away with this. Because who's going to fire him? He's unaccountable. Who's going
to
fire him?
To reiterate this, he is in the position he is because Boris Johnson thinks he's a genius. Is that basically it?
He's in a position he is. Technically, a special advisor is a civil servant. They're the only party political civil servants you're allowed to have in government. Every other civil servant is not supposed to be party political. They're there as the executive of the government's will. That's their job. The special advisors are allowed to take a party position, and they're appointed, not elected. So if Boris Johnson wants you as a special advisor, Boris Johnson will tap you on the shoulder and say, I want you to be my special advisor. And that is that's the interview process. That's it.
Dr. Bumjuice, I see him in the corner there. So Bumjuice, front and center.
when Dominic Cummings is involved, Bumjuice is always front and center. he sort of comes from a rich history of British media, which is powerfully bald men that basically go, this thing that you like, is it really good? Or the other article they have, which is this thing that you think is bad, maybe it's good. And that's basically like their only shtick that they can operate on. It's basically like the Toby Young scenario. he can pretty much like operate how he wants because he's got the right connections and he comes from he's been to the right places and he knows the hands to shake. And what that shows you about Westminster is that apart from the fact that there's already an unelected House of Lords, there is a cabal of unelected people that have huge amount of influence on the British electoral system. And, you know, they're usually capitalists and, you know, businesses who, it's not maybe as bad as it is in America in terms of, you know, what was it you would call it when you're...
like a lobbyist.
Yeah, exactly. But it still exists there, you know. Like, everyone in somewhere like Chuka Umunna knows that he's got a cushy job when he leaves politics. If he says the right things and, you know, plays the right game. And so it's a complete poison within the democratic system.
Can we say that just in terms of how many... So you have an unelected monarch, you have unelected lords... There's a Privy Council, last time I checked, which is, I think, what famously nicknamed the Secret Council because half the time people didn't know who was on it, and they had enormous power. You have civil servants who were unelected who had often unchecked power, special advisors with unchecked power. You have a parliament which is elected by first past the post, which basically means you can, on, 35, 40% of the vote, have an inordinate amount of power in parliament. Disproportionate to the amount of votes you got. We could probably keep going, but, you know, at what point do you not say that this is just an extension? Like, there's not much difference, not huge amount of difference to the type of aristocratic, oligarchic rule that exists from fucking 1688. I mean, just because they let a couple of middle class, you know, bourgeois people vote back in the 19th century. As Will was saying to us earlier on, like, one of the reasons when he was working for a certain political party, I'll let you guess, my listeners, which party he worked for, they didn't even bother to try and propagandize to those who were in the bottom of the economic totem pole because they didn't vote. Correct me if I'm wrong, Will. That's kind of what you said.
No, that is what I said, yeah.
Yes, I mean, at what point is this, you know, it's kind of this... the media presents an illusion of this kind of parliamentary democracy. It's not. It's an oligarchy. It's never been anything but that.
Well, I mean, it's the same establishment every time. It's just the faces at the top change. It's like the revolving doors with CEOs at the top of companies where they're just swapping around different companies to me. I mean, I don't really see much difference.
Bump juice in the corner.
Yeah. I mean, it's about invested power, you know. The peerages of the House of Lords are handed down from father to son in a lot of cases. Like, the people that own the land are the same families that own the land, you know, sometimes since the Norman invasion. So, you know, in some ways, the British Parliament is like a really weird, unique example. And it has its good points and its bad points, but mostly its bad points. But that's it. It's so archaic and so old that it just carries a lot of weight of it. That means that it's the historical precedents that are within the system that create a lot of these problems. Like, France has similar problems because you would say, like their parliament is only 200 years old or something like that, but it's still got families with it. I mean, Ireland's parliament is even younger than that, and it's got these problems in terms of like families that control politics and things. But it's just because, you know, Westminster is so old, it's just, you know, these problems are on steroids.
I did want to jump in just to say that I heard a really good, I didn't hear, I read a really good description of England from Bum Candy, Halftan Dan, in regard to the Normans. And since James brought up the Normans, Dan, would you like to give me your interpretation of the Norman occupation, the continuing Norman occupation of England?
Well, I don't think it ever really ended, did it? I mean, I think England was the first colony of the Normans in forming the British Empire, and I think we're still sort of the last. I think it's still the British Empire still exists. It just exists in England. I think what you're seeing now is sort of like the last remnants of it crumbling and almost like I'd say power grab, but they've already got the power. I don't know. It's difficult to really express it because when you're in it, it's just it's normal, but you have to sort of step outside of it to realise how abnormal it is.
So I mean, Nosha Kopp had his hand up there a second ago. I do feel bad about Nosha Kopp.
No, you're grand. I just wanted to point out lastly, I suppose, that Britain is a remarkable meritocracy. I mean, like, when we look at who's in positions of power, it's clearly a case of merit. And these people all have the same merit that they happen to be born or happen to have the good sense to be born into the right families. Credit where credit's due, guys. Like, Dominic Cummings did have the sense to be born to a wealthy aristocrat. Jacob Rees-Mogg did have the sense to be born to a wealthy aristocrat. David Cameron, the same. Boris Johnson, the same.
Just a point of order there. Can I put Jacob Rees-Mogg is not aristocracy. He's new money.
Yeah, they say this, but, like, I mean, his dad was, like, a lord and, like, was the editor of the Times and all that kind of stuff. I suppose it doesn't. It is still new money, technically, but, you know.
I suppose that explains his hard-on for the Victorians.
Yeah, that's where it comes from. Actually, like, if you wanted to do, like, a psychological reading of Mogg, it's because he feels... Because he's not from the same stock that Boris Johnson went to. He's got a real, like, inferiority complex about it. And so to counteract that, he feels he needs to be more posh than the poshos.
Yeah.
Mm. His nanny thinks he's posh.
We've been dancing around class, basically, because class is the real issue. And again, you guys are steeped in fucking the British class system because you grew up in it. So what the fuck is up with Britain and class? Can anyone give me what? Because I look. I mean, we have our own class system over here. It's different. Obviously, it's the similarities, but it's different. It seems such a toxic thing because it seems so entrenched that it, and actually quite popular in a really weird kind of diseased way. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of the people who are at the bottom quite like the way things are. I mean, I think after the last election, James Bumjuice, pardon me, posted a link to a guy who'd been working briefly with the Labour Party going door to door. And he said that the guy was like, well, what I realized by after knocking on like 147 doors or whatever it was, 147,000 doors, was that people at the bottom don't necessarily, you know, they don't think things can change. They're kind of happy with the idea of the crumbs coming from the table. They just don't believe people who are immigrants or are black and or whatever should have any of those crumbs. Is that what the class system is in England and in Britain?
The British class is very complicated because of its long history. But the main thing you have to remember is that the class system exists in two realities. The actual reality, but then the cultural reality that exists within the newspapers and people that have never been outside of, you know, Hackney and Islington. Because of Thatcherism in the 80s with, you know, right to buy, et cetera, et cetera, what you would say is hard and fast rules of class changed very, very quickly. And so you would say, like, growing up in the 90s, there would be someone that would say that they were working class because they had a flat cap and a whippet and they liked Oasis, but owned three homes. You know, which would have been a new thing. For in some ways, you know, Thatcher did let certain people move up the ladder in society by doing so, by taking that ladder away from lots of other people, mostly in the future. So class in the UK is really important because it's like it will determine what sort of job you're going to get and which skill you can go to. But it's often seen in terms of what your accent is and the way that you act and, you know, which which 90s pop band that you enjoy rather than your economic structures that will determine it.
So it's almost like separate communities with almost different culture, different language, almost different, certainly different geography. Is that kind of what it is?
It's even more complicated than that, though, because you would say, like, the Red Wall is a good example, that potentially the, you know, Labour lost in the last election, and effectively, you know, from the John Harris's of the world, it's all like, oh, they're up there, up in the north, doing their own thing, and they're obviously racist. And at no point in The Guardian did it ever kind of just point out, it's like, yeah, but maybe ethnic minorities can be working class as well.
You're right.
Like, the idea that, say, somewhere like Skye, up in Scotland, is hugely, hugely gentrified. It's, you know, lots of people that retired there from London that, you know, set up like a pizzeria or something like that. And there's tons of working class people there, but you just don't see them because they're stuck in their house because there's no buses to take them anywhere. But they wouldn't say, they would go like, oh, they're not working class because they have a Skye accent, which I know is to be a middle class accent.
It's not a cop, your hand is up.
Yeah, so I think like the thing I would just want to say is maybe that class in the UK is not an economic category necessarily. So like in Scotland, in some parts, there are bin men who get paid 40 grand a year. And like, which is, you know, a pretty damn healthy wage, especially in Scotland, which has a fairly low cost of living. But you wouldn't say, and no, I suppose no one would really say bin men in Scotland are like middle class. Similarly, football players in England, they get paid hundreds of thousands of pounds a week. They're still regarded as being working class. I suppose like what James was saying about having a cultural idiolect and, you know, like a certain language of their own and clubs of their own and, you know, to not put too fine a word in it, like an entire culture of their own. And it's one based on exclusion, fundamentally, that like makes Britain's class system so toxic. It's not just like, you know, can you afford to get into this club? It's about how you pronounce the city of Bath. Like, how do you pronounce Bath? Is it Bath or Bath? It's like, you know, do you have mayonnaise or salad cream? It's, do you put the milk in before you put your tea bag in? Do you put the milk in after you take your tea bag out? It's like bullshit like this. And it's like this secret language that everyone in the UK can speak. And like just these tiny, tiny differences in your attitude and tiny, tiny differences in your behavior will signal to people what social class you belong to. And it's hideous.
Isn't that more of like a caste system really than a class system?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
So, Bum Candy, it's your go.
Well, I mean, I remember reading a study a couple of years ago, and it kind of, it broke the British class system into, it was quite a few different pieces. Essentially, it was sort of your economic background, your familial background, your sort of geographical background, and your cultural background. And I think it was quite interesting to read, and that people could be considered middle class by if they went to an opera or something like that. So I think it can be quite fluid in certain respects. But then I think there's also this aspect of the class system where the people at the bottom of the class system don't really know that there is a class system. It's designed in such a way that the further you climb up, the more aware of it you become. And you're not taught anything about it. There's no, I mean, you don't read about it in the papers. You don't get taught anything about it in schools. There's no real sort of education about it. It's sort of instinctual. That's why I always found it interesting when Tony Blair claimed there was no class system anymore. And you tell that to me working minimum wage, you know, it's there and it's not there. It's really strange. But you're obviously aware of it. I've been more aware of it since the Tories have been in power, because you kind of see that divide widening between the sort of the middle and lower classes, especially, or working classes. So it's, unless you've really lived in it, it's difficult to define in a, it's not a really clear black and white sort of definition.
So you often say, Dan, you often say the people who you work with or people you might live near, that they sometimes like drive you mental because they, there's just like a stubborn, like willful ignorance about a lot of the things that the Tories do.
Yeah.
Do you think that there's a kind of a weird kind of, I don't want to be like a psychologist about this, but like a, like there's a willful kind of acceptance that's in the system the way it is. Basically, do you think a lot of working people, class people kind of really already know the things that people like socialists say are true, but they're kind of like, yeah, but I don't really care. Like there's some part of it I like.
Yeah, you know? I'd agree with that. I think that is a big part of it because I think ultimately, unless you're at the very bottom in British society, your life isn't that bad. I mean, comparatively to say some of the better places in Europe and stuff, it's not great, but when you compare it to a lot of other places in the world, and I think a lot of people are happy with their lot and they don't want to think about it because it's a lot to think about if you really get stuck into it. And most people just tend to want to get on with their lives. I think it's kind of a willful ignorance, not necessarily deliberately. I don't know. It's difficult to describe really. But to me, it's a case of that people sort of want to just get on with things and not think about it. I mean, I've been called middle class because I supported Labour. it's like fuck people's heads are.
That's astounding. Dr. Bundry, I see you there.
So the one of the main things that you have to realise about the British class system is it is kind of nebulous. And if you can accrue enough cultural capital, you can actually move up it. Now, me and Alex used to live together in Edinburgh back in the day, almost maybe 10 years ago now, something like that. Alex would often ask me why in certain situations I would sound like a middle-class person, why I dressed in a certain way, and how I acted in a certain way. And it's, you know, now I can see it for what it was, and it was a self-defense mechanism, because what I wanted to do was be a comedian and be in the theater, and that's an exclusively, that, you know, now as it was then, a middle class thing. And if I wanted to make headway in that, I had to shake the right hands and talk to the right people in the way that they wanted to be talked to, and talk to them about things that they wanted to talk about. And if I had outed myself as someone that had come from Leith, I would have completely shagged a lot of my opportunities that I went on to shag myself, really. But in Edinburgh, if someone found out you were from Leith, a lot of the time they would just, you know, think about giving you a job as a second. You know, it would be like, well, I'm not really sure, you know. And that's in Edinburgh. Like, most people should know the, at least the best bit of Edinburgh when they live there. A lot of my friends went to, you know, the best schools that you could go to in Scotland and, you know, in England. And
James, a lot of the people you had sex with went to the best schools in England.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, that taught me how to move in that circle and how I could, you know, pretend to be But yeah, as Alex pointed out at the time, what happened was I ended up in a self-loathing cycle, where I hated myself because I wasn't middle class or upper class, but because I was as smart, if not smarter, than a lot of the people, you know, that I had an inferiority complex to, that then, you know, caused a feedback loop. Because then I was like, oh, but why, you know, why am I not in their position? And this is what it really comes down to, is that we really need to readdress the class system in the UK and beyond, really, and make it more about material conditions rather than the cultural conditions. And so it should be something along the lines of, you know, do you get to choose the hours that you work? How much do you work and how much do you get paid for it? That determines your class system. You know, if you read Proust or, you know, like can get up on stage and do comedy, that, you know, and you talk about Freud, that shouldn't make you middle class by association if, you know, you're fucking delivering, you know, Just Eat orders every Friday, Saturday night, or you're worried about rent every weekend because, you know, your dad can't pay for it. These are the things that matter, and not, you know, your accent and what you read. Because there's this weird idea that, like, working class people have to automatically just be uncultured. And lots of working class people seem to think that's the way they should be as well.
See, that, it was never the case that was the way that, I mean, I can't remember where I was reading it, but a couple of weeks ago I was reading about, it was sort of early 1900s maybe, and it was people looking at working class culture and they were amazed at how many people knew the classics. I mean, there's a strong strain of anti-intellectualism in the British working class now, but I think that's been fostered more than comes from the ground up, because it wasn't always there.
Yeah.
If you look back historically.
Nasser Kopp, what's your opinion on this?
Yeah, so like I was just going to say, like, I think at the last couple of elections, there's been this mechanism, I suppose, like perpetuated by the news and by conservatives that has kind of pandered to like working class people trying to reject their own identity. So like at the last election, I think we mentioned this before, Boris Johnson's dad said most British people are thick as shit and they couldn't even spell Pinocchio or whatever it was he decided people couldn't spell. And I went into work and I was talking to a bunch of kids, not because, like, you know, for any weird reasons, but like I'm a teacher, so it's my job.
Thank you for qualifying that.
Thank you. Yeah, just that I've been watching that Jeffrey Epstein documentary. I thought I should clarify. So yeah, like,
this might give away too much about Will's identity, but Will can't. Was it like you're always warm? Is that it?
Yeah, no, I'm constantly warm. Yeah,
like I've seen him walk in like sub-zero temperature, and he was like fine in a t-shirt. It's fucking
ridiculous.
Weird.
I'm fucking boiling. So the kids, when I was saying to them, does this not offend you? And like, I teach in a really, really working class, like run down, economically and emotionally depressed neighborhood. And the kids were like, yeah, but like people, like everyone else is stupid. And their attitude was like, I'm not an idiot. He mustn't be talking about me. He's talking about everyone else. And of course, Boris Johnson's dad was talking about them. In fact, he was exclusively talking about them. And I wonder if this like self-distancing from their own social class is like a defense mechanism of the sort James was talking about, where if you think I'm not working class, I'm not grouped in with that lot, it gives them a sense of agency and self-control over the direction of their life. So they think, if I just change what I'm doing, my life will be fine. And it's a way of ignoring like the overwhelming torrent of economic and, you know, other material conditions that go into affecting your life. And it's a way of like obtaining some sort of sense of control. And I always like, I find this like really, really tragic.
So I think that there's another thing about it as well that's important, which is, again, it's a long-term view, but you could say that most historians would say pretty much into the 50s, say, there was three main classes, and you could probably fairly accurately pinpoint where they were. And as Dan said, you know, the working class were industrialized workers living in identifiable areas, usually by the 50s in council houses that had been built by the Labour Party. They were, again, very well read, but there was, you know, definitively that. Some people have suggested that there was a kind of a middle class colonization, which fits into the type of, you know, the Norman idea that Bum Candy was talking about, which is that, you know, there was this attempt to try and kind of graft off a segment of the actual working class, like teachers, people who might have been working in middle management or something like that, and say, no, you're not actually working class. You know, you're actually middle class or lower middle class or whatever.
Yeah.
And you're better than these people below you. And again, the curtain pullers who kind of look out the window and say, that person's been to the shop twice today or went on five runs. You know, there's that mentality. And so maybe that's kind of part of what we were talking about earlier, that, you know, England is, you know, in particular, but UK in general, that this was a process that has been a long time coming, 50, 60, 70 years of a process. And to try and turn that ship at this point, I think maybe something we should consider as one of our last questions is there a way for the left, and that is everyone from social democrats to socialists to communists to anarchists like us, is there actually a way other than the fucking country collapsing, as in the UK collapsing, you know, a la Yugoslavia in the 1990s, for this to actually change? And that's a heavy fucking question, and you don't have to fucking provide an answer, but maybe, you know, whatever your opinions are. I know Dr. Bumjuice's hand's been up for a while.
So we should probably wrap up pretty soon, because we're gonna do the next episode, and I got a meeting at 9. But the
short answer then.
You just need to foster class consciousness, you know? Like, as I've always said, what Labour should have been doing its entire existence is actually making some materialistic change to people's lives. If you want people to vote for you, fucking stop their landlord from evicting them, and, you know, be out there and get, you know, your boss to give you a proper wage or not to fire you because you were late too many times, etc., etc. Like, it's within our power to start changing things slowly and gradually, and then, you know, as history proves, there's always a spark point that just makes things go mental, and it's hard to see when they're going to happen or why they're going to happen. But if you've got the base there, if you're working on something, you can turn that into something that's useful. Where, you know, let's say, like, the big fault with Corbynism was it was something that happened first, and then the movement tried to rally around it, and it got pulled in too many directions by, you know, too many voices, and, you know, was corrupted from the inside. Where if there had been a coherent base within trade unionism and the labor movement and working class communities, Corbynism would have fucking sailed right through the door and into parliament.
Bum candy, go.
I think if you really want to build the left in this country, you need to undo the atomization of the individual by, well, okay, I guess, as you pointed out, it's been going on since the 50s, really, with the siphoning off of sort of working class identity into the middle class. But how you would go about that, I have no fucking idea. But it's definitely, I think the hyper-individualism in this country is one of the main steps, well, stumbling blocks to sort of a more collectivist idea. I mean, communities have been decimated, and not just the services, but the idea of community. Because, I mean, I live on a council estate, but it's individuals in houses. It's not, when I was young, people knew each other up here, but the houses were sold off, and they're private renters. So people come and go constantly. I mean, I've lived in this house pretty much all my life, but people either side of me, they come and go every couple of years, and there's no community because they're not there long enough. I think
there's a problem there.
Well,
people keep on living on them near me and then
just
moving.
Fuck off. I don't know where they go. But yeah, I think the housing market doesn't help, because that does encourage people to keep constantly trading up and moving on. And I think to some degree that is by design. That is part of the sort of Thatcherist design to break socialism over the long term, to destroy collectivism in that sense, destroy your connections to your community and your neighbours and all that sort of stuff. And I mean, that's where you build it on the ground, really.
But personally, I just think the country should collapse, but that's me, you know. I mean, I have a particular kind of, can the UK collapse now? It's been fucking, like, we left 100 years ago. For fuck's sake, this has taken a while, you know. You know, from the Irish perspective, we've been like, God, will they ever just kind of kill each other already? Jeez. Because I'm still hoping for the Celtic Union to happen, you know. Not a cop, last word is for you.
I have nothing to say. I think, like, you know, like Dan's points and James's points are, like, really good. I just agree with them, essentially. Yeah. No, I agree. I think it's the atomization of the UK. The place is a cesspit. That's my take.
Yeah. You go on any local news Facebook group and you see the average kind of idiot.
Oh, they're hideous. Like, yeah. The ones in Andover are so disgusting. It's unbelievable.
Row after row of ugly baldy.
Okay, Will, would you cut the recording now?
I will.
Okay, so that was your weekly anime podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. If you did, we'd really appreciate it if you shared it, clicked like where appropriate, and crammed it down your family members' ears where possible. Stay safe, combabes.